Accession number 27814, David, about Reel 12. You had one last final point about
that. One final bit, yeah, which my wife reminded me, well, in fact, my daughter reminded me the other day that I should mention. The Royal Yacht dresses overall every time it goes in harbour. This is another thing you have to do.
What do you mean
time.
By dressing? Explain that.
Well, it's, you know, bunting right away over the ship, over all three masts and the funnel, etc., from stem to stern. And that bunting comes out on any visit to a port. The amazing part about it from the people viewing it is that the central stream of bunting comes out the funnel. And it was the three badge feather's job, because the funnel man, he was in there making sure the bunting came out. I mean, again, most people think a funnel is just one big chimney. Of course it isn't. It's just an enclosure for half a dozen different pipes and what have you. So the bunting was stored in there, and that's where it came out. It was pulled out. It was pulled out by hand, by the crew. You just ran with the lanyards and pulled the bunting up. At the same time as you did that, you would break flags out on the masthead, each masthead, and that could be the national flag of the country you were visiting or whatever. Now, I had the duty once, more than once, but on this particular occasion, I had, what you do is you fold the flag and roll the flag, and you bind it in a certain way with a slip knot, and you hoist it to the top of the mast, and then when the order is given for dressing overall, you just pull and break the flag open. Now, unfortunately, for some reason, this flag didn't break, and the Queen was standing alongside me at the time, and I was pulling away like mad, and she looked at me, and she looked up, "Oh, look," she says, "it hadn't broken," just like that, and laughed at her. She thought it was hilarious. The chief yeoman was going scarlet up on the bridge, you know. But it was one of those things that, you know, I had to take the whole thing down, rebind it, put it up, and break it again. But it was, you know, it's just something that sticks in your mind that has happened, because, you know, this is what you really think about it, that because of the pomp and ceremony and all the rest of it, and the discipline, and everything's got to be perfect. The Queen in particular, and a lot of the royal family, have got such a fantastic sense of humour that it's no big deal to them if it went wrong, you know. It was just something that happened. And no way. There's only one member of the royal family who was not like that, and that's Princess Margaret. She did not like to see anything out of place, anything at all. She even went and told the skipper once that this same fella doing the flags, that he was sitting on the entrance to the funnel, sewing the bunting on the wire where it worked loose or whatever, and she went and reported him for sitting down on his on duty. I mean, he wasn't on duty. Basically, he was just doing a job, but she was a bit like that.
Was she unpopular as a result?
She was unpopular on there, yes. She was the only one, I would say, that was unpopular on there. Because she didn't talk to anybody. She virtually, you know, didn't want to know anybody that was not part of the royal party. She wouldn't respond if you say, "Good morning, ma'am," or whatever. No, it's just unfortunate, but Margaret was a bit like that, I think, generally. I think she was known to be a bit like that. She was a party animal, and that was her lifestyle. And you know,
so she didn't enjoy it locked away in a yacht?
I don't think she did. She very rarely went on there, to be honest. I can't remember where we took her on that particular occasion. I think it was the only time she was on there while I was on board. She had been on before, and I was warned that she wasn't the most amiable of people.
Now, what happened when you got? I mean, so in October 59, that was the end of your 2 years, or nearly 2 years.
Yeah.
And now you went to you seem to have spent about 6 months in Chatham Barracks. Anything about that?
Not really. No, that was just again. They tend. I don't know why. I mean, it probably doesn't happen these days, but in those days, they probably had more. More sailors than ships, or ship vacancies in ships, so you had various times when they hadn't decided where they wanted to send you. But of course, the other thing is, a barracks still has to run, and it has to have staffing. So, a lot of cases, it's deliberate. They need people in the barracks to, you know, to maintain. The whole of the running order of that particular establishment. So again, it's so why you're left there, you don't really know. Basically, it's just a quiet number for a while until they decide what they're going to do with you.
Now, your next posting's to HMS Cassandra in April 1960.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of a send-off. Can you tell us the story of the send-off from the Daily Mirror in the Cassandra?
Yeah, that's right. And I think that may have been why I was there for that period of time, and possibly others, because they knew there was a new ship being commissioned, and you know, maybe I'd already been earmarked to go on her, so that was possibly the reason. But yeah, I mean, I'd appointed to Cassandra, and we were told that because of the journalist Cassandra and the Daily Mirror, that Daily Mirror had decided to adopt the ship. And it happens a lot. Ships get adopted by various reasons, normally by the name, i.e. Norfolk, HMS Norfolk's adopted by Norfolk, etc., etc. And they really did us proud. The Daily Mirror, they told us they were going to give us a send-off party, which they did in Café Royal. The whole crew went up to the Café Royal and had a good dinner, entertainment, etc., etc. We sailed, and we eventually sailed to the Far East. It was a 5-week trip on our own, so again, it was one of those quiet periods. You had very little to do on the visual side, or in fact, nothing to do on the visual side. So it was all exercises and practice. I mean, they never left you just to sit around. It was, you know, we'll do some flag hoisting exercise or flashing or semaphore or whatever. But yeah, it was a five-week trip where the skipper decided that because we were going to be at sea non-stop for 5 years, anybody that wished to could just continue shaving, which normally you would have to request to do that. You don't request to grow a beard, because that's not what you're doing, or to grow a set, you're discontinuing shaving, i.e. you must not do what I've had now, you must not shave here, you must not shave under there. It's exactly what they say, discontinue shaving, you mustn't shave anything at all, whatever it grows, that's what grows. So, not everybody, but probably most of the crew decided, yeah, well, why not, you know, save us messing about in the morning shaving. So we all discontinued, and then about a week before we got into Singapore, they had the inspection of the captain and the first lieutenant came round and looked at everybody, and it was quite, some of them were quite comical. I mean, fellas with 3 or 4 hairs growing out, you know, this sort of thing. Mine was quite bushy, because I used to have to shave twice a day anyway if I was going ashore, for instance, in the evening. I wouldn't have to shave again, because it got dark shadow quite quickly. And there were a handful of us that were told, yes, if you wish to, you can retain the set. So I did. And I had that for some years, first one, and shaved off again sometime later. I probably had it for about a year, and I shaved it off at requested permission to shave it off again sometime during that trip, and grew again later on after I'd come home, I think. But yeah, I mean, when we got to Singapore, there were already Daily Mirror photographers and reporters over there, and they'd arranged yet another party for us in the canteen of HMS Terror in Singapore, the shore establishment there, where you dock, not, you know, just off of there anyway. And apart from the party, which Cassandra attended and came on board, they also took a photograph of every member of the crew. We just went and sat and posed for the photographer, which and they gave you one of those to send home if you wished to, etc. So Cassandra came on board to speak to us. I've got a photo there of that as well. They just followed our progress, really. That's the last we saw of anybody from the Mirror after that reception. And they just followed our progress. And to the next involvement with the Daily Mirror, wasn't really involvement, but the next recognition we had from them was we should have been on a trip, a show the flag trip to Australia, and doing an exercise, I think, with the Australian Navy as well. And we were on passage to Australia when we got a signal to say that Colonel Nasser decided he wanted to invade Kuwait, or looked very much like he was about to invade Kuwait.
That's Egypt.
Colonel Nasser from Egypt, was going to invade Kuwait. So we were told, you will change course and head for Kuwait, Persian Gulf, at maximum speed. And that's what we had to do, and it was maximum speed all the way. And of course, Daily Mirror were advised of this by somebody, I don't know who, but obviously somebody told them that's where we were going. And it was splashed across the front page of the Daily Mirror, HMS Cassandra, spearhead of the fleet, you know. In actual fact, I don't think we were probably there first, because the Bulwark aircraft carrier was floating around the area. She wasn't actually in Kuwait, she was stayed at sea, because being an aircraft carrier, she didn't need to come in. But we went up Persian Gulf and we sat on the sort of edge of Kuwait, awaiting action stations. We went to action stations as soon as, or before we got to Kuwait, and that's how we stayed for about 3 days, I think, 2 or 3 days. Colonel Nasser got cold feet and decided, no, I don't think he'll bother. So we would turn around back to Singapore. Unfortunately, it was too late to go to Australia. Everything was cancelled, the visit and the exercise, all the rest of it. Otherwise, again, the Cassandra's duties were as much the same as Home Fleet duties or Med Fleet duties or anything else.
What was it like? How did you take to the Far East, you know, Singapore? What do you think of Singapore?
I enjoyed the Far East, I really did. I want to go back there sometime, but I know that I wouldn't recognise it at all.
What did you enjoy about it then?
Not so much Singapore. I mean, that was always fairly sophisticated, but again, very nice people, and interested place, and a very good run ashore. Anywhere around the Far East was a good run ashore, basically.
What was a good run ashore? Just drinking bars?
You could just walking around those sort of areas is interesting.
Interesting environment.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the whole area, and Hong Kong even more so, because that was, I mean, they had a small business area, and it was a small business area then in those days. The rest of Hong Kong was Chinatown, really. I mean, they still had the shacks on top of the roofs of the buildings. Suzy Wong was still sort of up in everybody's mind, because she was an actual character. Susie Wong's bar was there and all this sort of thing. And again, lovely people. Always something going on. There's the other thing with it, you know, there's the fiestas and this sort of thing going on there in the Far East. Quite a lot compared with this country. In fact, a lot of countries have much more of this type of thing than we do. So it's an interesting area. The weather, of course, is a big help, although we had some pretty horrendous weather at times over there. We did have to spend 2 days in the Fleet Club in Hong Kong, Hong Kong Harbour, because we were anchored in the harbour at that time, and the weather was so rough. We went ashore one day, and the weather was so rough they couldn't run the boats. So we were stuck in the China Fleet Club. Very sad that was, with the bar open for 2 days constantly. But that nearly caused some friction, because there were a lot of Australians there as well, and they... Australians were notorious, the Australian Navy, I think it's probably all Australians. They had a notorious reputation for a sudden change in their character, particularly when they'd been drinking. You could sit there for half the evening having a fantastic social chat with them and laugh and joke and everything else, and then for no apparent reason, one of them would suddenly get up on his high horse, as Australians will do, and start the old, you know, English pom lark and all this sort of thing, and start causing trouble. And they did it fairly frequently, and it nearly happened in that China Fleet Club on that occasion. But it was so crowded there, because there were so many ashore, and it was the only place to take refuge because the weather was so poor, didn't develop into anything, because there's just too many bods around, certainly too many British sailors as opposed to Australians. I think they thought better of it, but they were a funny sort of crowd, the Australians, and they have that reputation for, you know, being a bit, it's not always intentional, I don't think, it's just their manner, and you know, they've still got it, as you can see from the cricket, it never changes, and never will. They just think they're superior to us, for some strange reason.
You were detached to the Belfast after an accident. I'm quite interested about it. You know, it's part of the War Museum now.
Well, that's...
What's your memory of your time on board the Belfast? You were going as a leading signaller, were you?
Yeah, that's right. It came about because I'd had knee damage 7 years previously, and played a lot of football in the Far East again. And we had a cup final, and I twisted my knee, and it just came up like a balloon. And I went back on board, and we carried on normal duties, but I was hobbling about. And one day, I'd been to see the MO, and the medical officer, and he said, "Oh, it'll go, usual thing." But I was hobbling about the bridge one day, and the skipper came up and said, "What's the matter with your knee?" I said, "Well, I damaged it again playing football," which he knew because he was there. I said, "It's no better. In fact, if anything, it's worse." And the MO's told me, "Work it off. It'll go." "Oh, no. He said, "I don't think that's acceptable. Not on board." He said, "I'll have a word with him." So he went and saw him. And the next thing I knew, I got an appointment at the Singapore Naval Hospital for tests, and they kept me in and said, "You know, you've obviously got some damage there. We'll keep you under surveillance," which they did. So I was in there for a while, and I decided to take the cartridge out in the end. And so I'd missed a fleet exercise that Cassandra was going on within a couple of days of my leaving. I think they probably drafted on a temporary leading signalman to take my place, which they tend to do if they can. So I was in hospital recouping, and I was sent up to up country in Malaya for a recuperation. I went with another fellow who'd had a hernia operation. We had a couple of weeks in a a small hotel up there, which was okay. I was hobbling about a bit, so we couldn't really do a lot. He wasn't exactly fit. His wound hadn't healed either, probably. Anyway, eventually got back to the ship, and the skipper sent for me. He said, you missed our exercise. He said, but the Belfast is going on another fleet exercise in a couple of days' time. He said, and I volunteered you to go, so that you keep back up to scratch with it.
Yeah, we're quite interested. You know, what did you think of that? I mean, that's a very different ship from what you're used to.
Yeah,
it's a big ship, isn't it?
Vastly different. I mean, I didn't like it. I really didn't like
it. Now, why didn't you like big ships?
Well, first of all, because it was an exercise, there had been more drafted on than me, which is, as I mentioned a while back now, that often happens in a major fleet exercise. You get additional staff coming on board to cope with the watch on, watch off system, which it would normally have to be. And first of all, the mess deck was completely overcrowded. I don't think I would have liked it anyway. It just seemed cramped. I mean, you had a row of bunks down here, a row of bunks along the bulkhead, and another row of bunks coming up the other side, and it was just congested. And then you'd have your tables and that, but of course they'd had a staff canteen, staff restaurant, if you like, also being a larger ship. And, you know, even after 5 weeks, I only knew, really, a few of the people.
Why?
Because you didn't see them. I mean, watch on, watch off, you never saw the other watch at all when you were down on the mess deck. And you didn't see quite a few of the ones you were on watch with, because they were either in the main signal office or on the flag deck or on the bridge. Or, as they will in major exercises, they might be down aft, particularly on a bigger ship, and they've got a small signal office down aft, this type of thing. So you didn't really see them that often. And you had the routine, and they didn't seem so friendly, to my mind. You know, I mean, they admitted themselves that there were crew members on board they'd never met, you know, after a few months, you know, at sea, on the commission. And I thought, well, you know, on a destroyer and below, you virtually know everybody on the ship before too long, for one reason or another, even if it's just bumping into them, and occasionally, or even ashore. But on there, it was a completely different atmosphere. Payday, I think I had one payday on there, and there's just a massive queue. You know, you're standing up on the upper deck, going along very slowly to pick up your pay. Same with going to for your meals, you were queuing to get into the canteen.
Any advantages in a big ship that you could see? It sounds like not, but
from my point of view, none. Absolutely none, and that's a cruiser. What a battleship would have been like. I mean, an aircraft carrier was even worse. I mean, people haven't got the faintest idea on who else was on board. I mean, 2,000 crew in some cases. I mean, they just never ever met half of them, probably more than half. I mean, if I'd have spent the Navy on large ships, I don't think I'd have enjoyed it, to be honest. Not at all.
So you were pleased to get back to the Cassandra?
Oh, very much so, yeah. I mean, Cassandra, I mean, destroyers were on with the largest, of course, anyway. I mean, the Britannia was smaller, less crew, and the reward, of course, was minute compared with them, so, yeah.
Anything else about the Cassandra when you got back to it, or...
No, just fell back into routine. What we didn't know at that time was our fate. We didn't know whether the ship was going to be sent home or whether we were going to be sent home and a new crew flown out. The Navy decided whichever they wanted to do, depending on circumstances and the ship itself. Obviously, being newly commissioned when we came out from the UK, the ship was in good condition, and I decided that, you know, the ship stays there, the crew goes home. I'm pretty certain we had nothing from the Daily Mirror when we decommissioned and went home.
And that's in March 1962, you flew back.
Yeah, and that was... I went to Mercury, I think, then for the Yeoman's Corps.
Now, anything about that? That's HMS Mercury, the signal school again.
And yeah.
Anything about the course? Was there anything new, or did you know it? No, I don't mean know it all, but did you know most of it then?
No, yeah, I knew most of it. I mean, things change bit by bit, which you don't necessarily get to know about on board, or they don't think it's necessary for individuals. I mean, obviously, things like codes and the crypto side, you have to be kept up to speed with those wherever you are. But general things as regards fleet work, or I mean, signalling doesn't change. In those days, it didn't anyway. Flags never changed, semaphore never changed, Morse never changed. Or at some stage during my career, of course, the phonetic alphabet changed.
But it was just another thing to learn.
Yeah, I can't remember when that was, but that was before, long before the.
Where is HMS Mercury?
It's Petersfield in Hampshire. Closed now, just not too long ago. That was the main signal school where virtually everybody went for courses for senior rates. And I guess they would have probably used it after Ganges and St. Vincent closed. I don't know. May well have done. But then it was generally senior promotion courses. It was not a bad place. It's a bit remote. You couldn't go anywhere walking over the little village. But otherwise, if you wanted to go ashore anywhere, it was a bus. Had to wait for a local bus to come in. But most people didn't go ashore very much from there. I mean, they had pretty good facilities, good canteen. You could go home weekends, or you did have to do camp duties again, as always, outside of your signalling side of it.
Now, I presume you passed the course, and that would entitle you to become a yeoman, but it didn't mean you were.
No way. Oh, no. The waiting list in those days was pretty long for any promotion, and for chief yeoman, it was 7 years, which was the main reason I came out in the end, because it was no point in stopping there.